Hello and welcome to the second episode of Target Zero Hunger, a podcast that explores the food challenges and solutions of our time, brought to you by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. I'm your host, Sandra Ferrari. In this episode, we'll take you into the labs of the joint FAO-IAEA Division of Nuclear Techniques in Food and Agriculture in Seibersdorf, Austria, where researchers are on the trail of a special kind of foil in our food chain, the food fraudster. Along the way, we'll hear from experts in Pakistan and India, but our journey starts in Rome. On a recent sunny Saturday afternoon, our producer Kim Jenna Yurian stopped by Beppe I Suoi Formaggi, a specialty cheese shop in the old Jewish ghetto in Rome, not far from the Tiber River.
Ciao, sono Kim, lavoro con la FAO.
Giuseppe Giovale's family has been in the milk and cheese making business for decades. The majority of cheese on display at the store is produced with milk from Beppe's own cows that graze on pasture far north of the city in Italy's Piemonte region. But there are also artisanal breads and carefully selected wines on sale in this quaint shop.
Giuseppe Giovale.
My name is Giuseppe Giovale. My role here is to discover good products from Italy, authenticity and simplicity. We used to be suppliers to this shop, and then we were proposed a collaboration with the former owner. And now we are the store owners, and we like to spread the word about good food and simplicity.
While Beppe and his staff are busy attending to customers and arranging the cheeses on display, Antonio Menconi, the store manager and resident bread expert, spoke to Kim Jenna about the importance of the authenticity of food.
Beppe's cheeses are made with the milk from his own cows. Some of the other cheeses we have here are French, and they are made with the same principles in mind. For example, the Parmigiano Reggiano we have here comes from a cooperative that is a partner of our cooperative, and therefore they produce under the same principles. The same goes with bread. The bread we have here I selected from producers who make it the way bread should be made. The world of cheese is truly fascinating. It's also a world of great injustice, because consumers these days buy whatever product. As a result, the quality of food has gone down a lot, and the prices paid by companies and the consumers is really low too. And the producers in many ways are barely surviving. The breed of cow that Beppe uses produces maybe 10, 15 liters of milk a day. The cows that are used in today's industrial scale production give 50, 60 liters a day. That's where the difference is.
Beppe later joined the conversation and we asked him about a recent case of food fraud involving Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. Some Parmigiano sold in the United States turned out to have wood pulp mixed into the ingredients.
And what about the cheeses on display here? Would it be possible that any of them have been tampered with?
Assolutamente no. No.
Absolutely no. When I taste food, I don't want to know its color or who produced it. I close my eyes and my mouth has to tell if it's good or not. I'm fortunate that I was brought up in a family where the authenticity of food was the most important thing.
Why is the authenticity of food important to you?
It's what gives us life, eating. Not just for me, but it should be like that for everybody. The most important thing for every person should be nutrition. If you are healthy, you live well and you can think well. If you eat things that are unhealthy, you can't live well.
Allora, posso avere uno di questi qui? Sì.
Perfetto.
E anche questo.
Thank you. For Beppe Giovalle, the authenticity and quality of his cheeses are his livelihood, and he's personally making sure each piece of cheese that crosses his counter is up to his high standards. But not every food vendor is able to have such a direct connection with their producers and the products that they sell. And even with artisanal foods like Beppe's, in the end it all comes down to a relationship of trust between the storekeeper and the customer. And the farther removed we are from those who produce our food, the more opportunities there are for fraud.
Well, for a period of time in 2007 and 2008, scandals involving the quality of imported products dominated the news in the United States. Consumers have had to deal with a seemingly never-ending series of revelations. The food industry has been especially hard hit. And now comes word that a brand of popular rice may not be all that it claims to be.
Each year, food fraudsters skim and scam about $50 billion from our food chain by passing off products for something else other than what they really are. Often this comes in the form of intermediaries mixing low-quality contents into high-quality products, but it can also involve elaborate import schemes by which fraudsters skirt around quotas and collect subsidies that they wouldn't otherwise be entitled to. This is a problem for consumers who want to be sure that what they eat is safe and authentic. It's a problem for producers who have a reputation to uphold and risk to lose business if their products get a bad reputation. And there are damages and implications at the national level for countries with trade relations based on the premium quality of a specific food product. But first, if you can't always tell with the naked eye when there's been foul play in our food chain, how does one catch these food fraudsters? Why? With stable isotopes, of course. Steve Thatchett, a colleague with the International Atomic Energy Agency, drove out to the agency's laboratories 40 miles outside of Vienna, in Seibersdorf, Austria. There he spoke to one of the lead scientists about how isotopes are the unlikely allies helping national governments and food safety experts combat these crimes that affect consumers and food producers alike.
Hello, my name's Simon Kelly. I'm a food safety specialist in traceability. I'm working with the International Atomic Energy Agency in the joint division of the IAEA-FAO Nuclear Techniques in Food and Agriculture.
Simon is an expert in analyzing stable isotopes. And stable isotopes are like Mother Nature's signature on food. Imagine that each chemical element in nature has its own identity, and that identity is created by atoms that have a certain number of protons and neutrons. What's important for Simon's work is that depending on where and how and under what conditions a food is produced, the number of neutrons in those chemical elements will be slightly different, and those variations are called isotopes. For Simon, they're like fingerprints on a crime scene.
It's been used since the early 1970s to detect the addition of adulterants in food, for example, to detect the addition of water to fruit juice. So the isotopes give unequivocal evidence because it's information which is actually stored within the atoms in the food and not just in its chemical composition. So, for example, we can look at oxygen isotopes, the stable isotopes of oxygen in the water in a fruit juice, and we can tell whether the water has come from naturally occurring oranges, for example, or whether the water has been added from a groundwater source because the isotopic signature is very different.
Even though it's hard to measure if instances of food fraud have gone down since these forensic methods have become more widespread, Simon is convinced that isotope testing sends a strong message to fraudsters.
It's a very powerful technique. And when organized crime syndicates and other people who might be tempted to carry out food adulteration become aware of these methods, it can act as a very powerful disincentive.
Simon explained that in some cases, these isotopic tests have become standardized industry methods, for example, to detect cane sugar in honey or the addition of sugar to wine.
These are all very established methods. There's an increasing number of examples now where stable isotopes are actually being incorporated into the definition of premium products such as Grana Padano cheese, Parmigiano Reggiano, so that the isotopic and trace element signatures or fingerprints of those materials is actually incorporated into their definitions. And these all act to protect the commodities and make sure that the chances of adulteration going undetected are very small.
In other words, you're only allowed to call your cheese Parmigiano Reggiano if it matches the isotopic fingerprint for Parmigiano Reggiano. But the technique is not just used in the richest countries. A large part of his team's raison d'être, Simon says, is to enable governments in developing countries to do the same kind of authentication and safety testing of their food.
We're very much in the business of developing the skills, helping developing countries with establishing methodologies, robust methods so that they can use stable isotopes to build databases that they can use to characterize their own premium products, such as, for example, basmati rice in India and Pakistan.
To hear more about what that quest for pure basmati looks like, we spoke to Mohammed Arif and Dilip Singh, scientists based in Pakistan and India.
My name is Mohammed Arif. I'm working as a principal scientist at National Institute for Biotechnology and Genetic Engineering, Faisalabad. My lab is a focal lab for the detection of adulteration in basmati rice using molecular markers.
I am Dilip Singh. I'm a professor in Department of Zoology, University of Delhi, India. This is a central government university, and I am working on food and feed traceability and environmental toxicology and soil microbiology. Actually, when you talk about the basmati rice, the word means the rice which gives the fragrance. And in India, mainly the area where the foothills are there, like a Himalayan region, we grow the basmati rice, and they are of very good quality.
In Pakistan, the Punjab is the premium basmati rice region. Both countries export a large part of their premium products to the European Union and the Middle East. Beside basmati, they also export other non-basmati rice to countries like Bangladesh, Indonesia, Philippines, and many African countries. Those different types of rice shouldn't be mixed. But a few years ago, the EU got suspicious and checked the basmati imported from Pakistan and India, and they discovered that it was indeed not as pure as it should be. In other words, there was non-basmati rice in the basmati.
And that was a main problem with the European Union, that they found more than 10% of mixing of non-basmati in basmati rice.
Arif explains that this food adulteration can happen at various stages and isn't always intentional. For example, in the Punjab, basmati and non-basmati rice is sometimes grown together. So at harvest time, the two can get mixed together. The other more benign types of mixing can happen when the rice gets to the middleman, who stores different types of rice in big heaps in their storage facility. And then there's the food fraudster.
The last stage is the food fraudster. Sometimes they intentionally mix the inferior quality rice with the basmati rice. Because for the basmati, they get very good premium quality. And in local market, basmati rice is more expensive as compared to the non-basmati rice. In Pakistan, if basmati rice is 100 rupees per kg, you can get non-basmati rice around 3 or 70 rupees kg.
India is dealing with the same nefarious market forces.
We are all facing the food adulteration, particularly in case of the India. People mix the non-basmati of the same kernel size, same appearance with the basmati rice. The price of the basmati, premium basmati rice is very high. But when they mix with the non-basmati rice, they take the same price, but the quality is compromised. So in that case, we need a technology, we need a system which can easily differentiate that what we are eating is actually the basmati or non-basmati.
As Arif and Dilip explained to me, there are various ways to test foods for fraud. You can look at the size of the kernels, for example, plus laboratories nowadays can easily use DNA analysis to test if a rice is high or low quality. But those methods are not good at determining the region of the product. For that, isotope analysis is simply the best tool. And that geographic marker can be a key quality factor for premium products like basmati.
If you grow basmati in UK or USA or outside the Punjab region, you will not get the same flavor or same aroma because it depends on the soil characteristics and environment at the time of maturity. So the region of Pakistan and India, they are the basmati region. We call it color tract. If you grow basmati in that specific area, you will get the aroma, you will get the specific pleasant flavor. But if you grow rice outside that Punjab region, you will again will not get the same quality. So quality is the main issue. So stable isotopes, they allow us to detect what is the origin of this rice, where it has been grown. Has it been grown in the Punjab region or it another regions?
From the isotopes, you can differentiate that this basmati is coming from India and this basmati is coming from Pakistan and this basmati is coming from some other part of the world.
Arif and Dilip both collaborate with Simon's team at IAEA to come up with the unique fingerprints for their premium basmati rice. In Arif's case, this includes collecting rice seeds, water, and soil samples from all over the Punjab and analyzing their isotopes. Now, we were curious to see how isotope technology is being used to catch import fraudsters. To help us answer that question, we talked to Andreas Rossmann, head of the Stable Isotope Laboratory in Germany, which is a commercial laboratory that has been doing stable isotope analysis since the late 1990s. More specifically, he talked about a case of butter fraud where the product itself was pure, but various companies in Germany and the Netherlands were re-importing their EU butter back into the EU under false pretenses so that they could garner more subsidies. Here is Andreas.
The butter which was exported was illegally re-imported as a product from Baltic states, from Estonia, for example. And as it was true butter, conventional methods of analysis were not able to differentiate this butter from said ones that has been exported before and paid by subsidies. And if a butter is exported and subsidies are paid, they cannot be re-imported to the European market. That was done illegally. And by labeling this re-imported butter as a product coming, for example, from Estonia. And with conventional methods of analysis, you can only check, is this butter or is it something else? But you cannot check, is this butter coming from Germany or from Ireland or from Netherlands or from Estonia. The challenge was to find a method to differentiate things which are chemically identical. And that is the advantage of stable isotopes.
After the case ended, what was the verdict for the fraudsters?
They have been sentenced to pay, I think, 2.1 million of euro of taxes.
Is isotope technology standard now in this kind of work?
I can say, at least in Germany, it's a standard technology for the food control authorities. They check, for example, wine or fruit juice or vegetables, if they are properly labeled or not, or if the production method is properly labeled, organic or bio, and the other production method is conventional. That means with mineral fertilizers, and that can be differentiated with stable isotopes as well.
But it's relatively new to use isotope technology in legal matters, isn't it? Why is that?
There was really a lack of databases. There was a lack of experts who are able to do that work. And the knowledge about the possibilities is still not very widespread in the food industry, and especially with regard to geographical origin. The food industry is not, I would say, very interested to know where the products really come from. They are mainly interested to have the possibly cheapest supply of materials. In some countries, for example, in Italy, it's very interesting for producers to label products with a geographical indication because they can be sold at higher prices. But there is also a very big risk that unscrupulous producers may take cheap starting material and, for example, prepare Parma ham or Grana Padano from these cheaper supplies.
What needs to happen in the industry, do you think?
If there occur problems, for example, in Germany, we have Stiftung Warentest, and they test products, and if there is something wrong, for example, with geographical indication, they write it in journals. And if such things are published, there is a big noise in the industry, and then they start to analyze their product and to check if it's really what it should be. But after a while, they forget about, or on the long run, it's too expensive for us, so they leave it away again. And if a new problem occurs, then we start again with this analysis. But there is no continuous control of all products as it would be necessary. It's partially done by the public control authorities, but they have limited resources as well.
Okay, we've talked about the economic side of food fraud, but there's one angle that's extra important to consumers, and that's food safety. It's one thing to pay too much for pseudobasmati. It's another thing to realize that there are contaminants and plastics in your food. It's this side of food fraud that's of particular interest to Marcus Lipp. Marcus is a food safety officer at FAO who works with the Expert Committee of Food Additives, a joint initiative by FAO and the World Health Organization. What do you think about using stable isotopes for mitigation against food fraud?
Food is complex, right? Food is dairy products, food is meat, food is vegetables, food is cereal. So it has a whole range of different compositions. Now, all these differences in composition demand very flexible approach to be able to identify that the Parmigiano Reggiano is in fact Parmigiano Reggiano and not wood. The rice that is labeled basmati rice comes from the right region. The wine that is labeled Bordeaux comes from actually Bordeaux and not from some other place. For this application, it works fantastic. Other methods don't deliver that strength of discrimination. Yet for other goals, other methods need to be employed. Food production in general and food fraud is actually a complicated and complex phenomenon with different angles. The economic damage that happens, the erosion of trust, the damaging of every consumer's perception that they don't feel safe if they go in the supermarket anymore. But there's also a different angle to that, maybe a little further reaching, because so far the story points out to low-quality food material being substituted for high-quality material, low-quality rice for basmati rice, which demands a premium in the market. So there's economic damage. But there's also food fraud where non-food items are actually used and disguised as food. So we all heard 2008, 2009 about melamine in infant formula that damaged thousands of kids, really health damage, kidney damage. And there's also fake rice. It's actually plastic that's disguised as rice. So there's real food safety aspects if and when food fraud happens, because the people who commit that crime, that food fraud, the very criminals, it's a criminal act in almost all legislations, they are the only one who knows what happens. Because by the very nature of that crime, they are not telling their customers or the consumer that they tried to cheat.
What are the main issues for you here from a food safety perspective?
From a food safety perspective, food fraud is relevant because it means that something has been added to food that nobody knows whether it's safe. No regulatory oversight can happen because nobody knows the existence of that until post-mortem, after the fact. Unfortunately, often post-mortem, because people will show some health effects or die.
What can the consumer do in terms of food safety?
We all can help protect ourselves against food fraud by a couple of different approaches. One is asking questions. We all can ask questions. We can call our regulators. We can call the companies. Most of the companies actually, I think by law, have to give a contact point. If not, there's always the internet. And ask question, how is that made? What goes into this food? Explain to me why I should buy your product kind of questions. That is the right of a consumer to know what they eat. And that's perfectly fair. They can talk to their regulators. How do you help me protect myself against food fraud? What do you do? There's also other things the consumer can do. There's always a compromise between convenience and having enough information to differentiate things. An easy example. A few years ago, there was this horse meat scandal in Europe where horse meat was found in burger patties. So everybody on the meadow can tell apart a horse from a cow. When the animal is slaughtered, the meat can still be identified, but it's a little harder. Horse meat is leaner. Cow meat is not so lean. Horse meat is a little darker. Cow meat, not so much. So it gets a little harder. If it's minced meat mixed together, nobody can tell the difference except the analytical chemist with his advanced tools, but this is not available for the common household. For example, black pepper. Typically, whole black pepper beans are easily identifiable. One of the common fraud mechanisms is adding twigs and chaff into black pepper and grind it all up, because once it's ground, it's a gray speckled mass. And I can tell apart whether this was a twig or was a pepper kernel. But if I buy whole black pepper, I easily can spot when there are twigs in there. So there are tools like this that the consumer can use to just use common sense.
What can be done at an international level to improve safety and mitigate food fraud?
We all need to work together to keep food safe. There's no single institution that is big enough, strong enough. There's no single country that is powerful enough to combat food fraud. If it's too good to be true, if the price is too low to be really true, it's probably fake material. Regulators need to pour in energy and pour in resources, and industry needs to play along, at least the good players, need to make sure that everything is above board, that food remains safe. So we all need to work together. FAO plays part of that through its Codex Alimentarius activities, setting food standards, for example. And there are numerous other activities in FAO. Other organizations play a part. Police work extensively on that. Interpol has extensive campaigns on combating food fraud. Regulatory authorities are concerned about food fraud all over the world and trying to work together and develop new ways of combating food fraud by establishing new processes and making people aware.
As we've heard, food fraud is big business within our global food system, but it's a crime that has implications and damages that resonate and cause ripple effects up and down the food chain, from producer to the consumer to the government. For over 50 years, the joint FAO-IAEA Division of Nuclear Techniques in Food and Agriculture has worked on the intersection where the fight to eliminate hunger and improve food security meets the peaceful use of atomic energy. Together, they support countries with training and technology to make sure their food is safe and authentic. And that is part of ensuring our global food systems are healthy and sustainable. In our next episode, we'll delve into the world of biotechnology and discuss with our guests what potential they hold and what needs to be done to ensure these technologies benefit smallholder farmers in developing countries. We'll hear from experts with varying perspectives when it comes to biotech. This episode has been produced by myself and Kim Jenna Yorianz, with special thanks to Steve Thatchett for collecting the interview audio with Simon Kelly in Zeibersdorf. If you have any questions or feedback for us, write to fao-audio@fao.org. I'm Sandra Ferrari. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the full interviews from guests in this episode, visit our website at fao.org/media/podcast for more information about the series.